Okay, we'll get you to grab a seat and we'll get underway with the Ecclesiastes. When I was a kid, I couldn't pronounce the book Ecclesiastes. I used to call it Clickety Clack Sticks. What do you reckon? Can we call it Clickety Clack Sticks? Well, let me start by adding my Mother's Day love to you all. Mothers, like Greg has already said, we love you, bless you. We salute you, basically. We honour you for your incredible efforts, undertaking what I would consider the highest calling you could give yourself to, and no doubt what comes with that is a massive sacrifice and cost along the way. I gave my mum a call on the way to church this morning, as I often get to do on Mother's Day, and my mum lives a little bit further away, so I won't get to see her today, but I usually say something to her like this, Mum, thanks, I love you, thank you for all your love. Thank you for feeding me all those years. Thank you for your guidance. And then I usually also thank my mum for giving me for doing all those things whilst also not smothering me. Yeah? My mum gave me a whole lot of line to kind of, she let me run and make mistakes and come back and figure things out whilst also loving me and guiding me. And I'm incredibly grateful for that, that she's always been there for me, but she lets me go. She has let me go, and I always thank her for that. Now, I am one of 16 children, so you can't hang on to all of them. No, I'm one of five. Oh, I love my mum, and I'm grateful to her. Also got the chance, you know, as you do, to help your own kids celebrate their mum this morning, and that works surprisingly well. It's normally just chaos and very opposite of helpful, but the kids did a good job this morning, and so... That was enjoyable to do that this morning. But I'm very aware that on Mother's Day, as we celebrate motherhood, and many of us get to celebrate that and enjoy a certain amount of joy in that, it's also the very opposite for many as well. As with most of these type of celebration days throughout the year, Father's Day, Mother's Day, Christmas, it's all the things that we celebrate, and things that get overly commercialised too, often what can come is, in the reflection on these things, grief and pain as well. And so no doubt some of you today are feeling grief because you've lost your mother, perhaps even recently, and you're feeling the pain of that. Or some of you are you feel like you've never had the kind of mum that you could easily celebrate, yeah? Because either she hasn't been there for you or there's been complicated things, and so it's awkward for you today. You're not sure what to do, yeah? Or some of you have had your own hopes for motherhood dashed over the years. You haven't been able to have the kids you've always longed to have, or you have had those kids but they haven't turned out how you longed for them to turn out. There's a whole bunch of things that can cause us to feel grief on these kind of days and not easily be able to celebrate these things. And as I observe how easily the pain and grief comes, what I observe is that pain and grief comes easily for us when there is deep desire for these things in life. And that's something I would notice about mothers. I've never met a mother who just takes motherhood kind of lightly. You know, it's just something they're doing on the side. You know, every mother I've ever met longs from a very deep place to raise healthy, happy kids that are well adjusted, and to do that whilst enjoying the process of raising the kids, and do that hoping that the end result is that they have a good relationship with the kids that continues. You know, every mother I've ever met has very deep longings for these things to go well. And so we're very easily disappointed when they don't. And the truth is you can't control how well they go. So we're left easily disappointed. But what I want to talk about this morning is it's not simply mothers that have these deep longings for life and things to go well. We all, have you ever noticed how we all, by nature, long for things to go well in life? We all seek happiness and well-being very, very consistently. We all desire enjoyment and pleasure in life. In life, we can't help ourselves but to pursue it from the very first day of our lives right through to the end. We long for happiness. And when I say happiness, let me define what I mean by happiness. I'm talking here about deep, lasting happiness. The kind of happiness that brings satisfaction and contentment and meaning and purpose in life. We can't help ourselves but to pursue that kind of happiness with our lives. and we pursue it in many different ways. And the reason why we pursue that kind of deep happiness is because we've been wired this way by a God who is like that. Yeah? Is that some of you would have been reflecting on chapter 3, no doubt, in your groups this week, chapter 3 of Ecclesiastes, and I'll just try and find the book of Ecclesiastes. Look at chapter 3, verse 11. We're going to spend time in chapter 2 this morning, but chapter 3, verse 11, we'll spend... By the way, the sermons will be slightly out of sync with what you're doing in your groups. We just made a decision to change it a little bit just to confuse everyone completely. But look at verse 11. He has made everything beautiful in its time. He has also set eternity in the human heart. He being God, the one who makes us, sets something in our hearts, designs us and wires us in a very particular way. And to say that he's set eternity in our hearts, I take it means this, that our hearts desire from a very deep place everlasting good things. And God's put that there so that you're not going to be able to help yourself but to really want things to go well and stay well. And that's just there. And you want it to be good for an eternity. We're wired with deep longings for glorious things that last. And friends, if this is true, then it's no surprise to us that when you sit back and you observe the way you live and the way everyone around you lives, that what we see is people constantly pursuing happiness in life. And again, the way I think it's the most easy to observe how keen we are to pursue happiness is by observing how easily we get disappointed when things don't go well. Yeah, let me reflect on holidays just for a moment. I'm just fresh back from a holiday, which actually went quite well. And I'm surprised at how well it went because I find holidays with young kids quite hard to make them work. I come back from holidays usually and people say, how are you going? You feeling relaxed? And I'm there going, relaxed? Since when did going away with young kids ever mean relaxing? I tell you how holidays work for me with young kids. The only way I can get them to work is if I go into holidays fired up, on the ball, ready to roll, super dad, super mum running holiday camp for kids from early in the morning. That's the way holidays work with young kids. Well, that's the way they work for me. And so I feel like we kind of pulled that off on this holiday. But one thing I'd notice about holidays, whether it's the family holiday or whether you're not in that stage of life, you're either younger or older and you're working on the travelling holiday, the experience holiday, different cultures and foods and whatever the holiday is you're working towards, I'd notice that holidays are easily frustrated. Very easily frustrated. All it takes is a bit of dodgy weather or it takes a bit of sickness or the vehicle you're driving in to break down, or the transportation to arrive late, or some kind of chaos to come in, and all of a sudden this holiday you've been working toward and thinking about and waiting for and putting a lot of hope in, all of a sudden it's frustrated and your dreams for it are dashed and you find yourself thinking, oh, okay, next time. My next holiday, I'm going to do it like this. Do you ever do that on your holidays? Well, sometimes I'm in the holiday and I'm thinking, oh, planning my next one, thinking, next time I come here, I'm not going to do that. I'm going to do this. I'm going to do it differently to try and make it work. Am I the only one that does that? Okay. And then I tell myself, oh, look, you're only frustrated because you had expectations that it was going to go well. So next time you go on holidays, just don't have any expectations. Because I call it the expectation blues. So I think, well, if you went into a holiday without any expectations that it would be good, maybe then there wouldn't be any disappointment. But the problem is, I cannot remove desire for things to be good. You can't do it. The Buddhist would say that's the secret to escaping suffering, is remove desire from life and then you never suffer. Problem is, you can't do it. You try to remove desire. You try to remove some level of expectation, even if it's realistic expectation for things to go well. You cannot do it. And I want to suggest the reason why you cannot do it is because God has wired you to desire good things. Your desire for happiness will never leave you. Your desire to want things to go well in life will never leave you. So we've got to figure out where it can truly be found and go after it. We've got to look at those who have gone before us and heed their advice and their conclusions and their warnings and see clearly where true deep happiness can be found and go and get it. I do think the way to do that is to spend some time reflecting on life and to do it regularly. And this is one of the things we get to do as we come to the book of Ecclesiastes. Now, I know, and I'm going to anticipate actually, because I've been speaking to a lot of people. We've only been in Ecclesiastes for 2 weeks now. You either hate it or you love it. Yeah? I love it and I hate it. Whilst on holidays, I had the book of Ecclesiastes open. Whilst enjoying a good holiday, I was trying to read Ecclesiastes, talking about the meaningless of life and the pursuits we go after. I've got to say, it was quite a challenge to be kind of enjoying this holiday, but then hearing how meaningless a lot of the things we pursue are. It's just like, you feel like you just want to close it up and put it aside, yeah? But I would acknowledge this. Whilst it is a great challenge to reflect deeply on life and consider things, and it's a challenge to read the book of Ecclesiastes, we must do it. It's wonderful to do it. It's actually super important in the midst of pursuing life in all the things we do to be reflecting deeply, stepping back from our lives and asking the question, is it working? Am I really doing the right things with my life? We need to examine our attempts to make life work. We need to look at our normal pursuits and ask big, tough questions. Can life be found in the kind of in the normal things where we look for it? You see, we live in a society, we live in a community around us that is continually giving us messages, continually speaking to us through the telly, through everything, saying basically this: yes, you can arrive at the happiness you're searching for here in this life. It's there for the taking. And usually when we hear that message, it's when a certain product is being advertised to us. We're being told to buy this thing and then we'll get what we're looking for. And it's usually this, which is hilarious. It's usually buy more of what you've already got and then you'll be happy. We've already got all the things that are being advertised to us. We're just told to get the next version of it or a bigger version or a better one. And it's so easy to get swept up into thinking, okay. I mean, it's do you ever get the, what do you call it, the buyer's remorse? I mean, I tell myself, life's not going to be any different when I get that thing, but there is something in me that thinks, no, when I get it. And then when you do finally get it, it's like, oh, it's just, that feeling never comes. You never feel like you've arrived. But we get told that if you get that credit loan, which is going to enable you to buy that car or that house, then you will be able to take a big, deep breath and be free. You know, or do this diet and exercise course and then you'll be able to become the person that you've always wanted to be and then you'll have arrived. Or buy this book or this course and read it and follow it and you'll get the perfect marriage. Or you'll get the perfect kids. Like I picked up a book this week. Someone had left it lying around. It was when we were away. What did the book say? Change your kids in by Friday or something? Friday. A new kid by Friday. What? Did you hear what Evie, my oldest daughter, she's 12? 11? 12? 13? Yeah. High school. She picked it up and she said, by Friday, what are you trying to change in me? You know, it's like, what's wrong with me? You know, kids don't get it, do they? But that, like, seriously, that's just ludicrous, isn't it? A new kid by Friday. But we love those kind of promises because that's what we want. I want a new kid by Friday. And when we hear these messages, and we get these promises fed to us, you've got a choice. You can either just believe them and keep pursuing happiness in those things by going after those things, or you can spend time pausing in life and reflecting. And I want to suggest that that's what the book of Ecclesiastes gives us the opportunity to do. Consider the reflections of a teacher who has gone before us and done some serious tests and experiments on life and come to some conclusions that we need to heed. I don't think we're very good at doing that in general. I don't think we're good at listening to those who have gone before us and learning from history. We usually tend to think that if someone has tried something and it hasn't worked for them, it's because they've done something wrong, but when I do it, it'll be different for me. You know, it's the classic scenario of, I'm not sure if you've ever done this, but you're heading along a four-wheel drive track in your two-wheel drive minivan, right? Because you're awesome and you've got your skinny tyres, right? And a four-wheel drive comes the other direction and winds their window down and says, just so you know, we just got bogged time and time again, and they've got a souped-up four-wheel drive. And they say, whatever you do, don't go that way. You'll get bogged. It doesn't work. We turned around and came back. Now, you've got a choice when you hear that kind of warning. You can either heed the warning and go, oh, thank you so much for warning me. It's good to know what's ahead. I won't try it. Or you can say, phew, you must have done something wrong. I'll be right. And off you go down the track. You know? I think what we've got for us in the book of Ecclesiastes is someone who has gone ahead of us in life and pursued life like you and I never will have the means to pursue it. He's got the finances and the wealth and the time and the opportunity to pursue all the things we go after in a supersized way. And he comes back to me and he says, can I tell you how it goes? Just so that you don't feel like you have to pursue those things in the same way I did. Will we heed his warning? That's the challenge for us. Come and have a look at it. We'll get into it. Look at chapter 2 there, verse 1. This is the teacher, which, by the way, may be King Solomon, but may be more likely a King Solomon type person, teacher. And the book, this book of Ecclesiastes has got bookends, a beginning and an end, which are written by somebody else that sum up the teacher's teachings and actually bring some conclusions. It's actually a tricky book to understand who wrote it and how it got written. But look at what he says in verse 1 of chapter 2. The teacher says, I said to myself, come now, I will test you with pleasure to find out what is good. I'm going to find out what's worth doing with my days. Look at verse 3, the last bit of verse 3. I wanted to see what was good for people to do under the heavens during the few days of their lives. So here's what he's saying. Seriously, what is really worth doing with the few days we have here? That's the question he's asking. What can you do to make life work? And when he's talking about life, he's talking about the few days that we have under the heavens. You see that language? Under the heavens. The language is more often than that under the sun, life under the sun. Now, no doubt you've looked at that this week. But life under the sun is to test out what's worth doing just in the physicality of life. To say I'm going to test life under the sun is to say I'm going to look at life apart from God, or without reference to any kind of divine being, without listening to any voice from outside speaking to us and telling us how to live. I'm just going to look at life and look at all the normal pursuits we go after, look at what people do, look at what I feel like doing, and ask the question, does it actually work? That's what it means by life under the sun. Just looking at the physicality of life and the pursuits that we normally go after. So the teacher is deliberately stepping into that position and saying, I'm just going to look at that kind of life. Ignoring a God, just what we tend to do with our lives. Now, you might read Ecclesiastes and think, this teacher just sounds like a grumpy old man just rambling on about how everything's terrible. But there's wisdom in this for us. The serious experiment that the teacher undertakes is this. He's going to seek pleasure and happiness in epic proportions. He's going to go after it at all cost. He's going to go all out. He's going to devote himself fully to the cause of pursuing pleasure. He's going to use all his time and his energy and his finances. He is going to saturate himself with pleasure. All the kind of things that we go after to pursue pleasure, to see if it works, this life under the sun. And the way he does it is very interesting. I think it's really helpful. He pursues it in three separate sections. He pursues crazy fun and having parties, which is what we tend to do when we're younger. And then he pursues working hard and building things with our hands, which is tend to what we do in the middle section of our life. And then he pursues the ultimate lifestyle where you just sit back and enjoy it, which is usually what we tend to do with the tail part of our life, the retirement. He says, I'm going to test all those big three things and see if any of them ever fully work. So he throws epic parties, he constructs epic projects, and then he lives an epic lifestyle. Let's look at how he does it. Verse 3, have a look at the parties, or an indication of the kind of parties that he threw. I tried cheering myself with wine and embracing folly. Yeah, that's an indication of him saying, right, I'm just going to party hard. I'm going to seriously drink lots and lots of really good wine with all my friends regularly, day after day, night after night. I'm going to chuck serious feasts, invite serious amounts of people to come and party with me, and I'm going to go really hard at it, and I'm going to laugh my head off, and I'm going to try to enjoy myself as much as I can and see if that kind of pleasure actually is lasting in any way. And if this is King Solomon or someone like King Solomon, it's worth thinking about the scale at which the teacher would have partied and thrown these feasts. If you go back and look at 1 Kings chapter 4, you'll see the scale of the parties that the kings used to throw. You actually see the kind of provisions that were required to throw these kind of parties. And if you go back to 1 Kings chapter 4 and look at how Solomon used to throw parties, let me just give you an idea of the kind of resources that it took to party every day like this. Copious amounts of wine. When you look at the daily provisions, 1 Kings 4, it says, every day required 600 kilos of flour and oats to make bread and pastries and all that kind of stuff. 600 kilos. 30 cows, 100 sheep, 100 goats, 100 deer, 100 chickens. That's a serious amount of meat, isn't it? Serious amount of meat, serious amount of bread, serious amount of wine, and that's all you basically need for a party. Just meat, bread, wine. No veggies or anything like that. But when you add up that kind of scale and that kind of quantity of food, it's likely the king was feeding approximately 20,000 people every day. Now that's a party, isn't it? That's a serious party. It kind of makes the kind of parties that we throw look a little lame, you know, where you invite everyone to come over, BYO meat, you know, I'll make the salad, you know, big old generous me, I'll make the salad. You bring your own meat and your own grog or drink or whatever. King Solomon would just look at the parties we throw and just have a little giggle at us because of the way he pursues pleasure. Now, we do what we can with the means we have, but he had infinite amount of wealth to pursue these type of parties, and he goes at it in a pretty incredible way. But then he quickly moves on to doing other things, which would suggest that it didn't really work. And you can kind of imagine how it might not work, yeah? No doubt, as he began the parties and had all his friends there, it would have been a blast to begin with. They would have laughed a lot. They would have had a great time. But then the next day, when you do it again, it's good. But then you do it again the next day, and it's like starts to get a little bit repetitive. And then the next day, and the next day, and the next day, it starts to get a little bit old and a little bit boring. And even though you keep ramping up the food and the drink and the entertainment, it just, you run out of things to do. So no doubt, he ran out of things to do. Laughter, he says, it's madness. Now, laughter is somewhat therapeutic. It is so good to have a good laugh. But I tell you what, there's a limit to the amount of laughter you can have that's therapeutic. I went camping with my son Levi, who's 5. He just started school this year, and I made this silly promise that I'd take him camping if he did his best at school. So I got stuck having to take him. I'm just not a camper, right? So it was a couple of months ago. I took him down to Patonga on a Friday night, and we camped over, and I did my best. I was being super dad. And we camped the night there, and he's 5. And so, you know, I'm trying to get him to sleep at a reasonable time, I don't know, 9 o'clock-ish. But there's kids screaming and running around. But we finally kind of got him to sleep at about 9:30. And then I lay there in the campsite whilst everyone else kind of finally got their kids off. And then all the mums and dads hit the drink and started to party. So I lay there, I reckon from about 10 o'clock at night till about 2 in the morning, listening to dozens of mums and dads around me drinking and laughing their heads off. I don't know what was so funny, but they were laughing and laughing and laughing and laughing. And I decided, no, I'm not going to get frustrated. I'm not going to be one of those people that starts, you know, ranting and raving. I'm just going to lie here and just listen. And I got to say, just listening to people laugh, sometimes you start laughing with them. You don't know what they're laughing at, but their laughter's so funny, you laugh along. But I got to say, yeah, it was fun for about half an hour. And then it just, like, laughter, as fun as it is for a moment, achieves nothing in the end. And no doubt the next morning they woke up with sore heads, not really remembering what was so funny. What's the point to it all? Well, kind of nothing in the end. A little bit of enjoyment along the way, no doubt. But end result? What? So he moves on. He tests the party scene, the pleasure scene, and then he moves on from that to the projects scene. You pick that up in verse 4, epic projects. Look what he does. I undertook great projects. I built houses for myself. I planted vineyards. I made great gardens and parks and planted all kinds of fruit trees in them. I made reservoirs to water groves of flourishing trees. So He pursues projects in a way that you and I would never be able to pursue them. You know, we sit and watch Better Homes and Gardens on telly or The Block, and we dream of all the wonderful things we could do with our little house or the house that one day we might get. You know, and we come up with all the dreams and the projects we think we have, and you think, if I could finally get, sometimes, you know, you think in your head or your heart, if I could finally do that with my house or get a house like that, I'm sure I would then sit back and go, yes. But you won't. Because look what he does. He doesn't just build a house for himself. He builds houses, plural. And if it is King Solomon, he took 14 years to build his own house. That's a serious house with serious fittings and serious decorations. In fact, if it's King Solomon, he built a house for every one of his wives as well. 700 wives? That's a whole suburb of houses. He just, when he decides to build things, he just builds a city. You know, so everywhere he looks, everywhere his eyes can survey, he owns it. You know, it's like that person that wins Monopoly because they just buy everything on the board. You know, that's King Solomon. He's like, I'm just going to build everything. Build every house I could ever imagine. And he does it. And on top of that, he builds, what did he say, gardens, vineyards, farms, fruit trees that produce excellent fruit. He doesn't just build a nice little veggie garden in his backyard or plant a nice little tree. He plants a forest. And he goes, see that forest? That's mine. I planted that. And then he builds reservoirs that actually water the vineyards and the forest. And in fact, if this is King Solomon, you can go to Jerusalem today and actually go to the pools of Solomon and you can actually see the remnants of the pools, the reservoirs that he constructed to feed the parks and the valleys and the forests that he built. He just went all out. You know, we watch the show, The Block. No, it's a great show. I mean, we look at all the things that happen and we sit back and go, wow, that's an amazing feat. King Solomon would look at The Block and he'd just go, is that all you got? Seriously? A little block? Mate, look what I can do. So he pursues projects in a way that you and I would only ever dream of. But obviously it doesn't work. Because simply building things so you can sit back and cross your arms and go, look what I've built, doesn't do it. Because he needs to move on after having built all those things to actually now start living in it and enjoying it and working really hard to enjoy what he's built, which is the next phase. Okay, there's obviously something missing. Just building things won't do it for you. He's got to now start to live the ultimate epic lifestyle in it and sit back and enjoy it and enter into his, perhaps what you might suggest would be his retirement years. And so look at verse 7 and onward. Look at how he pursues the epic lifestyle. I bought male and female slaves and had other slaves who were born in my house. I also owned more herds and flocks than anyone in Jerusalem before me. I amassed silver and gold for myself and the treasure of kings and provinces. I acquired male and female singers and a harem as well, the delights of a man's heart. I became greater by far than anyone in Jerusalem before me. And in all this, my wisdom stayed with me. So what does he do? He starts off and says he buys slaves, you know, people to do things for him. Now, we have these days, we have a service industry where you can pay to get someone to do something for you. You pay and someone makes you a coffee. You pay and someone makes you a meal. You pay and someone does your hair, or not if you just let it grow. You pay and someone will give you a massage and you can treat yourself. We call that the service industry we have. Now, that's what we do. He actually decided, no, he would pay and buy to have a permanent barista that would just live in his house and make him coffee whenever he wants. Yeah, he has a live-in chef and a live-in nanny and a live-in cleaner and a live-in masseuse and a live-in hairstylist and a live-in personal trainer. He has an entire team of people that live with him to help make life work for him. He has just dozens and dozens, hundreds of people that belong to him that are his beck and call to help make life work for him. We buy a song and put it on our iPod and play it. He hears about music he likes, buys the band and gets them to play for him. You know, we save up and buy a ticket to a stage production. He builds a theatre and creates a production company that just puts on productions for him and his own private audience. That's the kind of scale he did things, all for himself. And he gets a harem for himself as well. Not only has he got 700 wives, obviously not enough. He also has, if this is King Solomon, 300 concubines. Now, don't be mistaken. It's very clear what he had that for. He was pursuing unlimited sexual experience. There's no way of getting around that. Uninhibited sexual experience, on tap, 1,000 women. This is the ultimate Playboy mansion. Would have made Hugh Hefner look very, very lame with his 4 women on his arms. Here's Solomon with 1,000. Now, there's all kinds of things that causes that to be troubling for us to think about, which we're not going to be able to go into right now. The point is this. He pursues pleasure in every realm, all the realms we go after pleasure. You know, we dream about that one wife or that one husband where there can be wonderful intimacy, you know, and sexual experience like we want it to be. And Solomon just goes, I'm just going to get 1,000. It's nuts. He says there, verse 10, I denied myself nothing my eyes desired. I refused my heart no pleasure. He saturates himself with pleasure. You name it, he had it. He owned it, he did it, he lived it, he supersized it. All the normal things we go after, good times, parties, friends, lovers, marriage, children, properties, projects, possessions, service, entertainment, retirement, all the kind of things we go after, he just dives into it. And look at his conclusion. Here's what we must see. Verse 10, second half of verse 10. My heart took delight in all my labor, and this was the reward for my toil. So make no mistake, he does say that his heart took delight in his labor, meaning this, and you've got to hear this, there is a certain level of enjoyment in the pursuit of pleasure. There is a certain level of happiness to be found along the way, on the journey toward the thing you think is really going to help you arrive. But he says, that's it. That's the only reward I got for all my toil, a bit of delight along the way. Because when I arrived at the end point, it didn't do it for me. The pleasure was just momentary, and then it was fleeting. It didn't last. It's like I'm chasing the wind. It's like a vapor that you're trying to grab and you can never get it. He says, take it from a bloke who had everything. It doesn't do it for you. Now, you might think, this is an ancient guy. You might want to hear from someone more recent. Well, I got a quote here from Jim Carrey. Right? Now you might think, Jim Carrey? Well, yeah, he's an actor, a comedian, but a very successful, you know, very successful artist at what he gave himself to do and became very rich and very famous and everything he went after. Here's his quote. And actually, it's funny enough, Jim Carrey actually has a fair bit of philosophy that he espouses. Right? Here's one of his pieces more recently. He says this, I wish everyone could get rich and famous and have everything they ever dreamed of so they would know it's not the answer. There's Jim Carrey. You hear it from Jim Carrey. You know, it's funny hearing from Jim Carrey in church. You know, the fellow who played the guy from Dumb and Dumber. But he says, if you could have as much finances and as much fame or as much of everything you ever longed for, family, everything. If you could have everything you ever longed for, you would discover that life under the sun is not the answer. And here's a word for mothers on this. Even if you were able to finally arrive at that perfect family you always dreamt of and have the perfect children, hear this. Your deepest longings for life will not be satisfied by that. No doubt, delight along the way and a certain level of enjoyment in the process. Absolutely. Not denying that. But your deepest longings for life will not be satisfied by the perfect family. It's not where it's found. Look at verse 11. Yet, though there's delight in the process, yet, here's the end result. When I surveyed all my hands had done and what I had toiled to achieve, everything was meaningless, a chasing after the wind. Nothing was gained under the sun. That's just so hard to hear, isn't it? The guy who went after all the things we normally go after but got more than we ever would comes to that kind of conclusion. Again, he's not denying that there's enjoyment and delight along the way. He's just saying when you step back from it all at the end and ask, seriously, what did my life achieve? What is the ultimate end result? What have I gained? He says, nothing. Because the pleasure is fleeting. Now hear this. Pleasure is not the problem here. The pursuit of pleasure is not the problem. You and I are wired to pursue pleasure. We're made that way by a God of pleasure. We will always pursue it. The issue is this: where and how do we pursue pleasure? That's the issue. Can we heed the teacher's warning and listen to someone who has gone before us who says, don't go that way. It's not where it's found. Can we understand why ultimate pleasure and ultimate happiness cannot be found in the usual pursuits of life under the sun? Do you understand why? Do you know why? It's because life under the sun has been broken and corrupted by sin. Yeah? We live in a broken world. And you and I are broken people. So therefore, the pursuit of life under the sun will be constantly frustrated. Romans 1 tells us very clearly the impact of sin, the impact of rebellion from our God on life, and it's exactly that. It says sin means that people like you and I exchange God for created things. That's what Romans 1 says. We exchange the glory of God for created things, meaning this: instead of seeking pleasure in God, who is above the sun, we seek pleasure in his stuff, which is under the sun. That's the impact of sin on us. We keep going after pleasure in creation instead of in the Creator himself. And we start settling for temporary, fleeting pleasures under the sun instead of eternal, everlasting satisfaction in the one who made us, which is the very place where pleasure can be found. Pleasure's not the problem, but the way we pursue it is. Here's a quote from C.S. Lewis from his book, The Weight of Glory. If you've never read Weight of Glory, you've got to. The most important line is the one you can't see, but we'll get there. I'll tell you what it is, all right? It would seem that our Lord finds our desires not too strong but too weak. Yeah, our desire for pleasure. We are half-hearted creatures fooling about with drink and sex and ambition when infinite joy is offered to us. Like an ignorant child who wants to go on making mud pies in a slum because he cannot imagine what is meant by the offer of a holiday at the sea. We are far too easily pleased. That's C.S. Lewis. He wrote a lot of stuff that's really good, apart from the Narnia series, which is good as well. Here's his reflection. Desire is not the problem. Actually, our desire for pleasure is too weak. We pursue it in all the wrong places when infinite joy is offered to us elsewhere, in God himself. And how's that picture? Like an ignorant child that wants to just sit down making mud pies in a slum because he doesn't know that a holiday by the sea is offered to him. Far too easily pleased. So if you leave with nothing else from today, hear this: don't be far too easily pleased. Don't settle for fleeting and momentary pleasures in life under the sun. You were built for more. It will not satisfy you. Go after ultimate pleasure and go after it in the only place that it can be found, which is in the Creator himself, in him. And to kind of show you where our God says that quite clearly, I want to take you to John 4. So come to John chapter 4, which is one of my favorite little episodes where Jesus has an interaction with a woman by a well and says these very words to who? To her, to direct her to the very place where true pleasure in life can be found. And she's a woman who's very hungry for life and she's pursuing it in all the wrong places. Jesus comes across this woman, John chapter 4, and he meets her at a well, and it's just him and her there, and they have the kind of discussion that you have when you're at a well. They talk about water, yeah, making conversation. He asks her for a drink. And as she's getting him a drink, he continues the conversation but takes it to a deeper, more spiritual level, which she completely misunderstands, doesn't get it at all. But he says to her, if you knew who I was, you would be asking me for a drink and I would give you living water. And she goes, mate, you haven't even got a bucket. You know, how are you going to give me this? So she didn't get it at all because he's taken it to this deeper spiritual level. Yeah. And so she doesn't get it. And then look what he says, verse 13. Here's the verse I want you to tune into. Jesus answered, everyone who drinks this water will be thirsty again. But whoever drinks the water I give them will never thirst. Indeed, the water I give them will become in them a spring of water, welling up to eternal life. You know? He looks at her and he says, this water that we're drinking, this physical water, everyone who drinks this, you will be thirsty again. He's making a comment about life under the sun. You keep pursuing all the just the physicality of life, there'll be a certain amount of pleasure, a certain amount of satisfaction for a moment, but then you'll thirst again. And he's saying this to a woman who is so thirsty for life. She's pursuing it in places that are actually bringing so much damage upon herself. He knows she's thirsty for good things, and he's saying to her, you know where you can be truly satisfied? You know what you're really looking for? It's this other kind of water. It's living water. It's the kind of thing that only I can give, which is a symbolic way of saying to her, you come to me, have a relationship with me, and that will satisfy. That will give you what you're longing for. That will remove your thirst for life. It will satisfy that deep longing for happiness and pleasure. Now, some of you have heard this before. Well, some of you, perhaps this is new, something for you to consider. Others of you have heard this before, and you've heard, yeah, good. I know that's where pleasure is to be found, in Jesus. But you won't pursue it in Jesus unless you really do trust this. Do you trust that it is the place where deep, lasting happiness can be found? Because if you don't really trust it, you won't really pursue Him. You'll pursue everything else and a little bit of Him along the way. And if that's what you would observe about your life, that there really is no difference in the way you pursue life from everyone around you who doesn't claim to know Jesus, then perhaps your life might be evidence that you don't really trust that it's in Jesus that life is found. And we all suffer from it. Can be honest about the way you pursue life. We need to trust that God is the author of good things, that He is not the enemy of delight and goodness. He is not the cosmic killjoy. He created the idea of pleasure. It was His idea. You just got to think back to the garden. God created pleasure. He made a man and a woman and a place for them to dwell, and they were naked and unashamed. Enjoy, multiply. You know, like God came up with the idea of the good life. Seems strange for us running around the nude, but that was a good life. Pleasure was His idea, and He says, come to me and be filled. Friends, there is nothing under the sun that brings true, lasting pleasure. You need to look beyond the sun and find it in the one who made the sun. Pursue pleasure in the deep, lasting happiness in knowing the one who is the giver of pleasure. Pursue Jesus. Go after Him. Go after Him with your time and your energy and your resources. Be serious in your pursuit of Him if you're serious about the pursuit of pleasure. Pursue Jesus. And I do want to just finish up just now by trying to help you to think practically about what that might mean for you. It's important to put action on these things because you could possibly leave it here with this ethereal concept of, oh, okay, good, so kind of go after Jesus, that's nice, excellent. But what's that actually going to mean for you? If you're going to more seriously pursue the life that you were made for, and that means pursuing Jesus, what's that going to possibly mean for you? Because I trust that it will mean different things for all of us because everyone's at different places and different stages. So the question for you to ask, if you want to go after pleasure in life, if you want to go after happiness, and you understand that means going after Jesus, then the question for you to ask is, where am I at right now? And what would it mean for me to take the next step toward Him, closer to Him, in the direction of Him? What would it mean for me to pursue Him more seriously than I currently am? What would that mean for you? For some of you who are very new to this, it's simply going to mean investigating Jesus properly. You know, you've heard a bit about it, it's been on your mind for a little while, but actually take a step towards investigating him seriously. Take some action. Read something. Get to life. Do something. Actually look into this more seriously. For others of you who have been doing that thing for a while now, it may very well mean taking the step to entrust yourself to him and to actually believe in him, to trust him, to put your faith in him. Yeah? Which is to repent of sin and believe. Maybe for some of you, that is your next step. You haven't done that yet. But to seriously pursue him means entrusting yourself to him. For those of you who have entrusted yourself to him, and I know many of you have, and you have for many years, what does it mean for you now, being a believer in Jesus, being a truster in Jesus? What's it going to mean for you to more seriously pursue him from where you are? That can mean a whole range of things, yeah? For some of you, it might mean actually now, again, carving out some time to be with him, like you used to do. So you actually are giving him time every day, in the Word, in prayer, time with him. It's been a while since it's been a good habit for you, and perhaps that's the next step for you. I know that's simple, but it's profound. You can't pursue him without spending time with him, in the Word and in prayer. For others of you, it'll be getting swept up more seriously in his things, his church that he loves, and to decide to devote yourself more seriously to the place where his attention is, which is in bringing people into his family, into his gathering. There are many things that can hold us back from giving ourselves to Jesus and his purposes very seriously. But the problem is many of those things are trivial. We take them more seriously than we ought. And some things just need to be dropped. Because it would be an absolute tragedy to be pursuing many things at the expense of the one thing that's going to give you deep, lasting happiness, which is Jesus. So you may seriously need to drop some stuff to go after him more. I'd suggest that that's what it will mean. Because we're all busy. You don't actually free up time to do something differently unless you drop something else. Go after him. Get the help you need to go after him. Take action. Make a decision today. Pursue Jesus. Pursue him. Because that is where life is found. That is where life is found. Let me pray that that would be the case for all of us. Father God, we're grateful for your word to us. We're grateful for the book of Ecclesiastes, though we find it a challenge to understand. We're grateful for someone who has gone before us, who can give us their conclusions about life so we don't need to chase the very same things. Lord, would you by your Spirit enable us to heed the warnings and the conclusions that come to us here? Would you help us to analyze all of our normal pursuits and see that they're not going to give us the very deep lasting happiness that we're longing for? Lord, would you help us see that life under the sun will never truly satisfy us? That we need to look beyond the sun. We need to look to the very source of pleasure, and that is you. Lord, would you help us all to take this seriously? Would you help us to pursue pleasure seriously by pursuing you with our lives seriously? Would you, by your Spirit, enable us to focus our time and our energy and our resources on going after you? Lord, help us. We need your help to do that. Would you help us take action? Would you help us to take steps? We want to know you. Amen.